Thanks very much to Terry and Fiona for the first part of the session. We're moving on to something rather different now, looking at adults who have been diagnosed, whom we do know, and what happens to them as they move through the adult years. So our first speaker is Marcia Seltzer, who's director of the Weissman Center at University of Wisconsin-Madison. So thank you, Marcia.
Thank you. Well, good morning, everyone. It's great to be here. I'm very grateful to IMFAR for selecting this educational symposium, and I'm particularly grateful to be a part of it. It's just thank you very much, Pat, for organizing this session. And the work I'm going to be talking about is a collaborative venture with many colleagues at different universities, including some of my former postdocs or current postdocs, and so I will credit this army of investigators as we go along. So as we walk through the sessions at IMFAR and at other conferences, these are the images of autism that we tend to see. But we know that autism is a lifelong disorder, as Joe Piven published in 1996, whose features change with development. And so a great deal of what we've been trying to do during the past 10 or so years is to understand how the features of autism and the autism spectrum disorders change across the life course. And I'll be telling you a little bit about how what our study has been doing, our methods, and some of our findings during the past 10 years where we've been conducting research on a study that we call the Adolescents and Adults with Autism Study, the AAA study, which is a prospective longitudinal study spanning about 12 years in the lives of each family. And in the course of this prospective study, we obtain repeated measures from the mother, as well, to some extent, from the father and siblings. And also, we have collected data directly from the adolescent or adult with autism spectrum disorders, and we hope to do quite a bit more of that in the future. And our aims, broadly, are to investigate the change in the behavioral phenotype of autism spectrum disorders during adolescence and adulthood, and also the impact on the family. And I won't be talking about the impact on the family today, given the focus of the session. So we have 406 individuals with autism spectrum disorders in our sample. As Pat said, all of them had an independent diagnosis from a professional in the community. So this was not a clinic-based sample. And their diagnosis on the spectrum was confirmed with research instruments. And when the study began in 1998, the end of 1998, when we recruited the sample, they had a very broad age range. The youngest was age 10, and the oldest was age 52. About two-thirds of those were under the age of 22, and one-third were adults. Some people criticized us for being too broad in our age range, but looking back, that was a great decision to make because we are able to look as people transition into high school, out of high school, transition into the adult services world, and now some of them are reaching midlife and older age. This is a graphic presentation of what we've been doing during the past 10 years. This is a study timeline. Time 1 and time 2 are separated by 18 months, so that started back in 1998. And then 18 months after time 2 is time 3 and so forth, all of that light blue or turquoise boxes are each separated by 18 months. Then between time 4 and time 6, we paused and we collected daily data on the lives of families of individuals in our sample, and then after time 6, we resumed the every 18-month presentation of findings. So most of what I'm going to be showing you today are data from time 1, 2, 3, 4, and 6, which spans about a 10-year period, almost 10 years, and then also just a drop of the daily data, which is also very interesting, but not the focus here. A brief picture of what the sample looked like when the study began 10 years ago, or more than 10 years ago. The average adult was age 22. Three-quarters were male, so this looks familiar. About two-thirds were living with their parents at that time, although at each point of data collection, successively more and more adults move away from the parent home. Most were Caucasian. Three-quarters were verbal, meaning that they used three-word or more phrases. And 95% of our sample, when we assessed them with the ADIR, met the criteria for autistic disorder, although they possess a range of diagnoses on the autism spectrum. And the mean household income in 1998 was a little over $50,000. I'm going to touch on three topics today, which are just some of the areas that we focused on in our research. The first concerns change in autism symptoms and behavior problems using multiple strategies for assessing change, retrospective, prospective, and then I'm going to give you a little daily snapshot. Second, change that's specifically associated with exiting from high school, and then third, some comments about adult outcomes. So starting with change in autism symptoms and behavior problems, the data I'm showing you have all been published in JAD. The first was a paper that we published in 2003 where we reported on our first administration of the ADIR to the sample members at time one. And although it's true, and I completely agree, that older caregivers may have a difficult time recalling symptoms, with a lot of help from Kathy Lord in the early phase of our study, we decided to apply the ADIR to even though some of the parents were elderly already. And I think it worked out well. I'll show you some prospective data to confirm this general pattern that you see here, and that is that the lifetime rate, that our sample, almost 100% of our sample qualified in terms of their lifetime scores on the ADIR for autistic disorder, and that's true in terms of communication, social behaviors, social reciprocity and repetitive behaviors, as well as all three symptoms. But in terms of the current manifestation of autism, at time one, when individuals were averaging 22 years of age, quite a bit lower rates if that's what if their behavioral manifestation at that stage was all that was used to diagnose autism. So what we see is that the current rates of autism, if that were an appropriate diagnosis, would be quite a bit lower than the lifetime rates. So do these individuals still have autism? That's a question that's asked. And our conclusion is yes, of course they do, but there's a life course trajectory to each of these symptoms. Autism in adolescence and adulthood does not have the same phenotype as it does in childhood. We are fortunate to be able to follow these symptoms prospectively. And the next bit of data I'm going to be showing you was a study that was led by Paul Shattuck, former grad student, and published in JAD, where we looked at change in autism symptoms over the first four waves of our study, which span a 4.5-year period. And so we administered the ADIR at each point in time, I'm showing you current data from each of these four points in time. And we divided the items that we administered into four subscales: impairments in nonverbal communication, impairments in verbal communication, impairments in social reciprocity, and repetitive behaviors and specialized interests. And this is what we found. So the blue bars indicate stability, and we define change by half standard deviation units. So the red bars show improvement. In other words, people whose ADIR scores improved in a particular domain by more than a half a standard deviation during this 4.5-year period. The yellow bars are those who worsened by more than a half a standard deviation during this 4.5-year period. And then the blue bars were all the people who stayed stable. For nonverbal communication, stability was the dominant pattern, and an equal number improved or worsened. But for social reciprocity, although the majority were stable, there was significantly more improvement than worsening. And for verbal communication and repetitive behaviors, there was significantly more improvement during a 4.5-year period, measured prospectively, than either that there was significantly more improvement than stability or worsening. And so the prospective data seemed to confirm the retrospective accounts as well. We also looked prospectively at change in behavior problems. We used the SIBR to measure behavior problems, and the SIBR has algorithms that translate into an internalized score, an externalized score, and an asocial score, as well as a total maladaptive score. And we administered this at each of our multiple points of data collection. And you see that on all three dimensions, as well as the total maladaptive score, again using this half standard deviation metric to indicate improvement and worsening, that what we see is a dominant pattern of stability in behavior problems. However, significantly more individuals improved. In other words, their behavior problems became less severe during the 4.5-year period in terms of internalized behavior, significantly more improved in terms of externalizing behavior, then got worse, and significantly more improved in terms of asocial behavior, then got worse. So although the majority, the modal response was stability, we see significantly more improvement than worsening during this 4.5-year period. Now, this is a little snapshot about daily life for adults with autism. Essentially, all of the individuals whose moms participated in our daily diary study were adults at the point of data collection. And this was an 8-day study, and at the end of each day, the mother participated in a telephone interview on a variety of topics, but one of them had to do with the daily behavior problems of their son or daughter, repeated every day for 8 days in a row. The bar all the way to your right shows whether there was any episode of behavior problems manifested by the son or daughter during the 8 days, and 94% of the individuals in our sample, there was at least one episode of behavior problems manifested during the 8-day diary study. This is work that's been led by Dr. Leanne Smith, a collaborator at the Waisman Center. But what you see is the particular behavior problems that are manifested on during this 8-day study vary considerably. Obviously, repetitive behaviors, it's not surprising, is the most prevalent. But we see very high prevalence. Over 50% had an episode of being withdrawn or uncooperative, over 60% during the 8-day period. About 20% were destructive to property, and almost that many were aggressive to others, and 24% were self-injurious during this 8-day period. So behavior problems are highly prevalent in this community-recruited sample of adults. So this becomes a target of our concern as we think about future research and clinical implications. So to summarize this portion of the talk and then move on, we saw symptoms and behavior problems becoming less severe prospectively as individuals move from childhood to adolescence and then into adulthood. And prospective findings during the adolescent and adulthood period confirm maternal retrospective reports. And behavior problems remain very, very prevalent in adulthood. Virtually all adults in our sample have behavior problems, at least within an 8-day period. Now I'd like to zero in on changes in symptoms that accompany the transition from high school out of high school. And this is work that's been led by Julie Lowndes-Taylor, who's at Vanderbilt University now and is a former postdoc. And this is very exciting work. And we zeroed in on the 242 individuals in our sample who were in high school when our study began, and we've been tracking them prospectively. And 92% of those individuals exited high school between the 10-year period between time 1 and time 6, if you remember the life course of our study. And so what I'm going to show you is work that we've published in JAD showing the change of in the slope of behavior problems and autism symptoms before the individual exits high school as compared to after the time when the individual exits high school. And I'm just going to show you two of the many graphs that we have that tell the same story. The first focuses on ADIR, autism symptoms, and this particular graph shows repetitive behaviors. The vertical line is high school exit, and the negative points to the left of that are while the individual is still in high school, 4 years before they exited, 3 years, et cetera. And the positive sign, the points on the right, are after the individual exited high school. And these graphs were estimated using multi-level models. And what we see is this is repetitive behaviors in the ADIR, so a high score is worse. What we see is that everyone seems to be improving while they are in high school. In other words, their symptoms, repetitive behavior symptoms, are getting less severe. The rate of improvement is much greater for those who do not have intellectual disability, the blue line, than those who have autism and intellectual disability, the red line. But what happens around high school is a pivot, and that is that the rate of improvement slows down, particularly for those with autism who do not have intellectual disability. And that pivot is what we saw on all of the subscales of the ADIR when we performed this type of analysis. Using multi-level models. And we see a similar pattern with respect to maladaptive behaviors, again using the SIBR, that same measure I mentioned before, significant reduction in severity of maladaptive behaviors. I'm showing you internalized behaviors here, but it's true across the board. Improvement, in other words, lessening severity during high school, Then there's a pivot around the high school transition where the improvement slows down. But here the story is complicated by socioeconomic factors, and it was very, very interesting to see that those individuals who are in the lowest, the families with the lowest household income, those are portrayed with the dotted lines, they actually get worse when they leave high school. And you see that their symptoms begin to get more severe again after the high school transition. And that's true for both those with intellectual disability and those who do not have intellectual disability. And we can think about a whole host of reasons why that may occur, and we're following up to examine those now in terms of access to services, social resources that their families may or may not have. But it's a particular concern to see individuals with autism spectrum disorders from low-income families actually getting worse, not just slowing down their rate of improvement, but actually getting worse. So we have found that leaving high school is a significant turning point because the improvement that is evident during high school slows down. And there's, as I said, less improvement, particularly among the, or worsening among the lower income families. And it's those individuals do not look different during the high school years. They're both lower income and higher income families are improving during the high school years. But when they leave the service system, the educational service system, that's where you see that divergence by income. And then there's less improvement after exit for those who do not have intellectual disability, which was a opposite of what we were expecting. I think it points to the need to look at what their lifestyle and services were after they left high school. And that brings me to my last bit of data that I'm going to be presenting here, which is a comparison of three age-matched groups. One group is our sample of adults who have autism spectrum disorders but not intellectual disability. The second group are those in our sample who have both autism spectrum disorders and intellectual disability. And the third is a sample of adults with Down syndrome who were taken from a previous study. And many of the results I'm showing you have been published in a paper by Anna Espenson and Summer Bishop and Julie Taylor, as well as Jan Greenberger and myself. And that's the basis for most of the data I'm showing you here. So what we did is we categorized the three groups on the basis of their residential independence. And the categories that are ordered there in the legend are independent, semi-independent, in other words, some services in the home, living with family, living in a community residence of some sort, or living in a hospital or an institution. So working our way from Down syndrome into autism, you see that the dominant pattern of adults with Down syndrome was living with their family, with no one living completely independently and very few living in other arrangements. All of these individuals were living in Wisconsin and Massachusetts in both the Down syndrome and ASD samples. For those individuals with ASD and an intellectual disability, the most prevalent place of residence was in a community residence. And I think only one individual in the sample lived independently. Some were living semi-independently and some with family. And those who did not have an intellectual disability but who had autism spectrum disorders in our sample, the modal response was living with family, but many were living independently, about 15%, and some also were living semi-independently. Then we looked at vocational independence, and currently we're drilling down to get a more precise understanding of the complications of vocational placements and jobs in this population. But this is a broad brush view of this, and what we classified individuals as having a competitive job, a supported job, working in a sheltered workshop or a day habilitation or day activity center, or not having any vocational placement. Again, looking at those with Down syndrome, the modal response was working in a sheltered workshop. And the modal response, or the modal vocational placement for those who have intellectual disability as well as autism spectrum disorder, was a day habilitation program. So they had less access than those with Down syndrome to sheltered workshops. But some were working with support in the community, and just a few, maybe about 5%, had competitive jobs. And when you look at those who have autism spectrum disorders and do not have intellectual disability, you see much more competitive jobs in the community or supported employment. Here's social contact with friends, which is the last of the dimensions we looked at for this analysis. And what you see is that there's quite a range in frequency of social contact with friends. We measured it as several times a week, once a month, less than once a month, but still at times, and then never. And you see about 30% of adults with Down syndrome never had social contact with friends. About almost 45% of those with ASD and intellectual disability never had social contact with friends. And about a quarter of those with ASD who do not have intellectual disability never had contact with friends. And sort of the reverse, when you look at the several times a week, it's more prevalent in Down syndrome than in the autism groups. So then we wanted to put all of this together into an overall level of independence index. We gave 4 points for those who lived independently, 4 points for seeing friends several times a week, and 4 points for competitive employment. You didn't have to have all three of those to get 4 points. We just gave each of those outcomes 4 points. And then we gave 3 points for semi-independent living or seeing friends once a week or having supported employment. 2 points for living with family, seeing friends once a month, and sheltered workshop. I know this is a sort of a crude way of trying to bring a multidimensional set of outcomes together, but that's what we did, and I think it was quite informative. And this is what I should say that 1 point for living in a community residence, seeing friends less often than once a month and participating in rehabilitation, and 0 points for living in a hospital or institution, having no contact with friends, and no vocational activity. So this is a scale that ranged from very low to very high levels of independence. And this is what we found. So adults with Down syndrome, over 50% of them were classified as having moderate levels of independence. And if you jump over to adults with ASD who did not have intellectual disability, it's about the same percentage who had moderate levels of independence. And this tells us something about the burden, I think, of autism symptoms in terms of independent lifestyles in adulthood. In other words, those with Down syndrome all had intellectual disability, and yet their adult outcomes in terms of level of independence was more like those with ASD who did not have intellectual disability than those with ASD who did have intellectual disability. So those with ASD who do have intellectual disability really have a double burden, and that we have to consider their lifestyle outcomes as a very important priority for our field. So to summarize, adults with ASD and ID have poorer adult outcomes than similar adults with Down syndrome. Very few are independent. Even those who do not have intellectual disability, very few live what are conventionally considered independent adult lives with independent residence, a competitive job, and frequent social contact. And these profiles point to a lifelong reliance on the public service system and the family. So to say a few concluding words about the behavioral phenotype of ASD in adolescence and adulthood, the good news is we see decreasing symptoms and decreasing severity of behavior problems across the life course, but the symptoms significantly slow in their improvement following high school exit. And we see, again, using conventional standards of adult outcome, limited vocational success or residential independence or social integration among adults with ASD in their adult years. And so just a few words of implications and then I'll end. There's an imperative, I think, to continue to provide treatment and services that address the symptoms of autism and behavior problems in adulthood. And behavior problems in particular, we have found to be a major barrier for independence. The slowing of improvement after high school exit points to the need for intellectual stimulation and a meaningful lifestyle after high school exit, and the importance of post-secondary education is pointed to by these data, although there's very little known yet about post-secondary education for young adults with ASD, although we're going to be moving in that direction in our research. I have a plea for targeted adult services beyond the developmental disability service system, particularly employment for individuals with autism spectrum disorders, and the importance of the need for support for families who are providing support across the life course, especially those low-income families who have children with ASD. So I'll end there. I acknowledge my many collaborators, many of whom are in this room, and thank you again for including us in this wonderful panel. So thank you very much.